Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. My name is Dick Beeman. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan is a welcoming congregation. We are part of a liberal religious tradition that has no sacred text, that embraces truth and wisdom wherever they can be found. And although we reject dogma, we do adhere to the seven principles that are printed on the back of your order of service. I'd like to extend a special welcome to visitors, and I encourage visitors to sign the guest book by the front door there and to indicate whether you would like to be on the mailing list. And are there any visitors that would like to introduce themselves or be introduced? Well, we welcome everybody. The announcements can be found inside your order of service, and I want to call special attention to the announcement on the Chili Fiesta. Today is, I think, the last day to sign up for that. It's next Saturday. That is a fun event, so sign up today. You don't have to pay today. You can pay later, but do sign up today. Larry, would you light the chalice? Thank you. Today, the chalice flame, I'll let Larry get it going before I tell you what it is. Today, the chalice flame represents the spark of artistic creativity. To be an artist is to believe in life. Art washes away from the soul the dust of everyday existence. There are painters who transform the sun into a yellow spot, but there are others who, through an intelligent and creative spirit, transform a faded yellow life into a sun. Are there joys and concerns? Connor has one.
My joy is that I raised $515 for the Special Olympics on the Polar Plunge, and I won the costume contest another year. And I'm on the paper. And I'm also on the paper.
Our daughter, who's 60 years old, has spent the last 8 months having chemotherapy, and she's finishing it today along with total body radiation, and tomorrow she gets infused with her own stem cells and can go home and stay away from, I guess, practically everything until her, her own system is strong enough to keep her from getting infection, but it's end of a long, tough slog, and we're very happy about it.
Larry Weaver, another note from the newspaper this morning. One of our members, Michaela Sievers, got the top spot, number one in the Martin Luther King Jr. writing contest. Michaela's a high school student and number one.
Shirley Holbrook, membership chair. And I'd like to announce that we have a new member, Mark Clark. Mark, would you stand up? And we have another new member, Sarah Hoyt.
Gene Sievers. I'm co-president of the local Columbian Artist Group, meeting at the Columbian Theater monthly, and we have our annual show at the Columbian Theater right now, and I have a couple of harvest jars there.
Other joys and concerns? I have a joy. Yesterday, my wonderful wife and I celebrated a wedding anniversary. And the numbers don't matter, but it was the 13th time that on our wedding anniversary, we celebrated a prime number of years of marriage. That last happened 6 years ago. 13th time. Okay, Charles is going to lead us in a hymn.
Is that coming through on the headphones? That's not it. So for this hymn, I interpreted the word hymn actually in a rather liberal sense. I'm going to talk about my time today that I spent in Brazil and the work that I did there working with culture and teaching photography. And learning Portuguese and speaking Portuguese, of course. And it's interesting, the word hymn in Portuguese actually has two meanings. It would be used as we use the word hymn in English, and it also would be used as the way we use the word anthem in English as well. So it has those two meanings in one word. So today we'll do some hymns, but they're not associated with the church in maybe a traditional sense. They're hymns that are related to popular art forms. And this first one has to do with capoeira, which is a Brazilian, I don't know if anyone's heard of that, but it's a Brazilian fight dance. And it involves always a group of people together with instruments, a giant circle, and people clapping, singing, and dancing and fighting. It's a beautiful thing. And so today I think we'll isolate a part of that, which is the song part, and recreate a little bit of that spirit here. So we're going to sing in Portuguese, right? As I'm sure all of you've all been practicing, right? but if you haven't, it's cool. I guess I need two helpers to do this, because I've got to play this thing here, which in Portuguese this is called a pandeiro. So if there's two people that want to come up here and help me out. This is all right. This is an experimental hymn. I'm saying this already because I've never really done this before in this setting. But so there's two words that we have to learn in Portuguese. The first is this one. Maybe show it to everybody out there, and we'll practice these words before we actually get into the song. Can everyone see those? They're very similar. The first one, which is now over on the left side, is pronounced Paranauê. So we'll break it down into syllables. Paranauê. Okay. The second word, Paraná. So, Paranauê. Paraná. All right, and so the way things work in capoeira is that there's usually a group of musicians we'd be in a giant circle, and the musicians stand at the head of the circle in the middle, and they usually have several instruments, a tall drum, an instrument called a berimbau, which is a wire attached to a tall stick, and a pandeiro, a tambourine. We don't have those instruments today, but we have the most essential one, which is what everyone else does in the circle, and that's your hands, right? So with the lyrics, then, we have to have a clapping as well, right? So the clapping goes like this. You guys are good. All right, so let's try to put the two together now. And the way it works with the singing is that the master, the mestre, as he's called in Portuguese, or she, stands at the front of the circle and sings a line or sings a part of a chorus, and there's always the people, the chorus, who responds with another line. So I'm going to sing both parts, and you guys, we'll see how this works out anyways. All right. So it's like this. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. And then you guys repeat what I sing. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. Paraná, Paranauê, Paraná, 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 Uê, Paraná. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. Good. Paraná, Paraná.
Audience, when they sing.
All right. We can do that too, I guess.
We'll hear your words.
All right, so that's how the chorus works. And then when I sing a verse, all the chorus has to do is respond with the word Paraná, right? So it'll be like this. Mulher para ser bonita, Paraná. Não precisa se pintar. A pintura do diabo. A beleza Deus que dá, Paraná. Good, that's it. So basically there's the chorus then, and there's the verse. Paraná is the name of a state in the south of Brazil. And Paranauê might be a play. I'm not exactly sure what Paranauê means. It's one of these words that's so universal. I imagine it's something to do with Paraná, maybe the act of traveling. Capoeira oftentimes... as it was kind of originated in the northeast of Brazil, which is where I lived, a lot of the lyrics have to do with leaving home and going to a place and then feeling homesick or wanting to go back home. So it might have something to do with that. The lyrics are, the verses always vary. The one that I sang right then was, a woman to be beautiful, a woman doesn't need to paint herself or put on makeup. Makeup is the devil's work. And beauty is what God gives you. The lyrics are great. They're little pearls of wisdom. Let's try this then. Let's try the chorus. Let's just do it. Let's go for it. This is experimental. So I'll start the. Let's try it with the clapping. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. Paranauê, Paraná, Paraná, Paranauê, Paraná, Paraná, Paranauê, Paraná. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. Good, all right. Keep clapping. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. Paraná, Paraná, Uê, Paraná, 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 Uê, Paraná. Paraná, Uê, Paraná, Uê, Paraná. Mulher pra ser bonita, Paraná, não precisa se pintar, Paraná. A pintura é do diabo, Paraná, a beleza que Deus que dá, Paraná. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. Paraná, Paranauê, Paraná, Paraná, Paranauê, Paraná. Paraná, Paranauê, Paraná. Paranauê, Paranauê, Paraná. uma mesa, Paraná. Um garfo, uma colher, Paraná. O enfeite de uma cama, Paraná. É um homem e uma mulher, Paraná, Paraná, uê. Paraná, uê, Paraná, Paraná, uê. Paraná, uê, Paraná, Paraná, uê. Paraná, uê, Paraná. Paranaway, Paraná, Paranaway, Paranaway, Paraná, Paranaway, Paranaway, Paraná. Thank you.
Will the kids come forward? Tom Manny is going to talk about cameras.
Now it's on. Okay, so we're going to talk about cameras. Everybody know what a camera is? Is that a camera? It could be, couldn't it? Yeah, it's got a little camera in it, right. And let's see, here's some things here. Does that look like a camera?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an ordinary camera. Does that look like a camera?
Yeah.
Have you ever used a camera like that? This is a cool camera. Look at that. It folds up. Comes out. Yeah. Now, those of you, by recognizing these, you will give away your age. Now, how about that? Would you guess that's a camera? Do you know what kind of a camera that is? That's a Brownie camera. And it used film. Well, still does. But you take it apart and you put film in here. Anybody doesn't know what film is? Do you know what film is? I'll show you some film. You don't see much film anymore. This is a roll of film. And that's what you use to make pictures on. And the neat thing about this kind of film is when you bought a roll, you got this really cool little plastic case to go with it. And you don't see those much anymore either. Now, this really goes back. Anybody ever use one of these? That's an old, it's an Agfa SureShot. But the neat thing about this is you look down through here and you see what you're going to take. But how do they work? Do you know? Have you ever taken a camera apart? No? Oh, well, if I have something that doesn't work anymore, I always take it apart just to see how it used to work. But this is another camera, and this one is called a view camera, and this one happens to be about 70 years old. Have you seen that? Yeah, professional photographers use them. So this is the lens, that's what makes the picture, but where's the film? Let's bring it out here. And now I'm going to want you all to come around here and look at it. So why don't you stand up and walk over here, and we'll move that way a little. because you need to see the back end here. On your feet. Here, let's go back over here, and you come around on this side. Yeah, because we need to see this side. Now, what do you see there? Not much, huh? That's the lens. Do you see a picture?
No.
No picture. Well, I'll show you how you make the picture. See that there's nothing in there, is there? There's no electronics, no transistors. Let's put this back on it. And then open it up. And what do you see? Upside down. Why is it upside down? Yeah. Well, does your camera take pictures upside down?
No.
Well, you know, it really does. Except that when you get it, you automatically turn it over. But all cameras actually take pictures upside down because that's the way the lens works. Lens makes an image that's upside down. Did everybody get a chance to see it? Now, so take turns so that everybody can see it. Yeah, take turns there.
Look.
Yeah. Mark, you want to switch that to video? Yeah, I think you have to keep it pointing at the window in order to really get a picture. Huh?
It looks like that's battery slow.
Does it? Yeah, it does. We might. Well, I was going to use this camera to show everybody else what you guys are seeing. The yellow one.
Jocelyn.
Here. Okay. So since nobody except the kids get to see what we're doing usually, I brought Mark's little camera in here to show you. And indeed, the picture is low battery level. Okay, so much for that part.
We could plug it in.
Well, that's all right. So the question is, how do you get a picture out of it? You can look at it, but how do you get a picture? Well, you need some film, and this is the film. This isn't really the film. This is just the film holder, and you see it has this slide that covers the film. Of course, I just ruined the film because it's exposed to light. But what you would do is go in the dark, in a dark room, and slide these sheets of film into the holder. And then you would close that, protect it from the light. And once you had your picture, what you wanted to see, you'd put that in there, pull the slide, and take the picture. And if you've seen this in movies, the photographer always has a black cape. Have you seen that? So what's that for? Well, that's really so the photographer can see the image on the screen in the bright light. So you poke your head under there, and then you can see it. But if you notice in movies of old photographers, they always take the picture with their head under the cloth, which doesn't make any sense because you can't see anything when this is in the place. But that's the standard ritual. And okay, so that's a view camera. And that is the easiest thing to see how they work. Any questions? Okay, so how do they get that little, that camera inside this little tiny thing? It must be magic, right? Yeah. Okay, that's it.
Great, thanks,
Mom. Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go.
I have a short reading called Masterpieces to Go, The Trucks of Pakistan by Richard Covington. Art is not a luxury but an essential expression of the human spirit. Many anthropologists see religious significance in all prehistoric art, for example, a cave painting of a bison as a prayer to the animal's spirit for a successful hunt. But maybe prehistoric art was in part simply an aesthetic response to the perception of beauty in the natural world. This next excerpt is from Richard Covington's article. This article appeared in the March 2005 issue of the Saudi Aramco World, or Aramco World, and it was about the flowering of art in the most unlikely places. Under the shade of a colossal banyan tree in Karachi, Pakistan, a truck painter, Haider Ali, 22, is putting the finishing touches on his latest creation, a side panel mural of Hercules subduing a lion, rendered in iridescent, undiluted hues of purple, yellow, red, and green. His 10-year-old nephew applies a preparatory undercoat of white paint to the wooden prow that juts above the truck's cab like a crown. All across Pakistan, this rolling folk art has turned village lanes, city streets, and long-distance highways into a national gallery without walls, a free-form, kaleidoscopic exhibition in perpetual motion. The vast majority of Pakistan's trucks, buses, and motorized rickshaws are riots of color, adorned top to bottom with eye-popping landscapes, portraits, calligraphic poetry, religious verses, and wisecracking expressions of star-spangled banter. Only the biggest, blandest container freight trucks, the 18-wheeler rigs, escape decoration, looking naked by comparison. And now Charles is going to give us the offertory. Many of us know Charles as the son of John and Judy. Charles Extell is a Kansas native, of course, grew up in Manhattan, graduated from the University of Kansas in 2005 with a bachelor's in Latin American Studies and Spanish Language and Literature. He's been in Brazil for the last 6 years, I guess, Charles, working with AECTEA, which is a local educational and cultural center in, I apologize for all the upcoming mispronunciations, in Capim Grosso, a small city in the state of Bahia in northeastern Brazil. Charles has written several successful grant proposals funded by the Brazilian Ministry of Culture, which offers support for cultural awareness and pride in less wealthy regions of the country. And with his long-standing interest in photography, Charles designed a course of instruction, recruited professional photographers to help teach the course, and wrote an introductory essay and translations for the book that was published as a result of those efforts. And here is some background information that Charles provided about the course and the book. We are a federally funded art center known as a Ponto de Cultura, focusing on community development through art classes and other cultural projects. Our photography course educates teenagers and adults in the language of photography, while forging connections with other areas of social and cultural importance. Our outlook places particular emphasis on art as a means of building personal values, understanding the world, and contributing to one's community within the context of social and cultural marginalization common in northeastern Brazil. Recently, 17 students from the photography course concluded their second year of studies, and after winning a state grant, were able to publish a book with a selection of their color documentary work. The book is entitled Capim Grosso, and it contains more than 60 images of life in the interior of Bahia. It is complemented by two essays that give context to the project, a sample of which can be viewed at the blog, and then you can get the URL for the blog from me or from Charles. And so without further ado, Charles Extell to discuss the photographic spark, community empowerment through art in Bahia, Brazil. Charles.
Thank you, thank you. I'm going to kind of use this microphone here as opposed to this one because I'm going to go up there and show some slides at some point, so I think it might be easier. Thank you for having me here, and I'm glad to be back in the congregation again. It's been a while, 6 years, I guess, though I have been back since I've been, since I came back to the U.S. in October. And I titled this talk, The Photography Spark, because photography played a major role in some changes that occurred in a small town in the state of Bahia in the northeast of Brazil. And I think, you know, art for me is a huge spark. It's something that really inspires me. The music that I played here, all the pieces are kind of classic, either Bahian pieces or inspired by Bahian culture. The first song was from Capoeira, and that's something that arose in the sugar plantations in the interior of Bahia, where slaves were involved in various covert games in which they had to kind of, I guess, disguise what they were doing. Instead of actually fighting, they would pretend like they were dancing together. So they would throw a kick or a punch, but it would be part of a graceful movement to the side or a roll on the ground. And it's now internationally recognized as being as Brazilian patrimony. And it's something that people do all over the world. So that was an element of capoeira, something that really inspired me about Bahia in Brazil. The first piece I played on guitar was Birimbau, which is by a modern classical composer named Birimbau, who was inspired by that instrument I talked about. It was a stick with a I guess it's kind of like a wire attached to it. And this is also something I think is beautiful. There's lots of different, I guess, like quality or variety of wood that works for this, but you really just need like a wire from a tire and a stick, and then like I guess a hollowed out, you get a gourd, scrape out the insides, and you attach it to the wire, and you play it with another stick like this and a stone. It's a really simple instrument, but it's beautiful. So he was inspired by that, and he composed the music Birimbau, which is supposed to kind of imitate the sound of the Birimbau. And the last song I played is Azabranca, which is composed by not a composer that's not from Bahia, but he's a famous forró musician, which is kind of like northeastern folk music. And he composed the song in 1947. It's called Azabranca, which is, I guess, kind of like the white dove, maybe, which is a bird that lives in the sertão, which is the desert region where I lived. And it really is a hymn and an anthem all rolled into one. Wherever you go in Bahia, people will know how to sing that song. So those are all little sparks, I think, that kind of inspired me over the time to stay in Bahia. It wasn't my intention when I went there first to stay for 6 years, but, you know, you catch these sparks, you know, and they kind of propel you forward, and you're like, man, this is really cool. I want to see what this is about, right? And you end up staying. So I wanted to share those with you first and try to get you into, bring you inside a little bit of what I love about Bahian culture, which is its rhythm and its kind of oral nature and its festiveness, and try to pass a little bit of that on to you guys. So I think Dick ran down the basics about the book. I want to show some slides of a lot of the stuff we've done. There's a lot of photographs, and I think photographs really, they say so much about a place. And I want to show you the work that my students did, as well as the stuff we have online, the blog, and some other slides of what my little dear town looked like in Bahia. But I thought I'd start out with, I wrote this big thing, it was like 6 pages, and it was like this whole linear thing, and I mean, 6 years, I don't know how to really get inside that, and it's you know, I threw it out basically last night. I was like, you know what, I'm just going to tell some jokes in the beginning, because that's I think what maybe a Bahian would do. They really love jokes, you know. So I have two jokes here. And these are something, you hear these in Portuguese a lot. I've translated them to English. I hope they come out all right. But anyways, a Bahian is laying down in his hammock, and he calls out to his mother. He says, "Hey, mama, do you have any medicine for snake bites?" And she calls back, "No, I certainly do not. Why, did a snake bite you?" And he says, "No, ma'am, but there's one coming right my way." All right. Second joke. A Paulista is someone from São Paulo, which is the biggest city in Brazil. It's one of the biggest cities in the world. It's got 25 million people or something like that. And the Paulista is someone from São Paulo. So the Paulista, he's sweaty and he's tired and he's been working away in his suit and tie and he sees the Bahia in his hammock whistling away and asks, "Hey, Baiano, don't you know that sloth is one of the seven deadly sins?" And the Bahian responds, without batting an eyelash, "Oh yeah? And what about envy?" So these are actually very popular jokes. I've heard these multiple times. I'm going to try to use them to demonstrate a broader point. And the first joke is kind of a crude stereotype of Bahians, you know, in the sense that people always assume that they're lazy, and it's something you hear all the time. Anyone from other places of the country, particularly the South, just automatically assumes the Bahians don't do any work. And it's funny, I was actually out here meeting some of the Brazilians at K-State, and I ran into this one of the Brazilians from the South at this bar, you know, and we were going back and forth about everyone has a lot of pride in their region in Brazil, you know, so they know the South is like this and the North is like this, and he's like, you know, and he looks at me, he's like, yeah, but the Bahians are so lazy, you know. And I was like, "Oh yeah, have you ever been to Bahia?" And he's like, "No, I guess not." I was like, "I lived there for 6 years." And then he looked at me. He didn't know that I lived there, you know. So he looked at me, and his face kind of just like melted. I was like, "I lived there for 6 years. The people I knew weren't very lazy at all. In fact, they worked really hard." And he didn't know what to say after that. But it's just something that, if you weren't talking to someone from the Northeast, it would just kind of go. It would be assumed that they were that way. You know, it's a common stereotype. And what I like about the second joke is this way of kind of flipping that idea on its head a little bit, in the fact that you know, maybe the Bahian works less than someone from São Paulo who really does kill themselves every day, you know, working long hours in a really polluted, dirty city, as opposed to the more rural lifestyle that most of Bahia lives. But you know, they ask, "Aren't you a little bit jealous, anyways? Don't you kind of envy us in the end?" You know, and there's a certain pride I think the Bahians have when they tell that joke, because they're okay with who they are in a sense. They're saying, "All right, look at it. You know, we're Bahian, and maybe we work less than you, but we're okay with that. That's kind of part of our identity." You know, and I think a lot of what making this book was about, which is the result of all these years as a photography teacher there, was about people from the community kind of standing up and saying, "This is who we are." I mean, it's a very, very simple act, but it's not something that people can always easily say. It can be quite difficult, actually. And I think that in the case of Bahia, it's especially difficult because, you know, it's a place that the word Bahia is such a loaded term. It's just a place with this amazing history. It's where the Portuguese first made contact with South America, and it has all this African culture. You know, there was, of the 8 million slaves that came to the Americas, 40% ended up in Brazil, and of the 40%, you know, there's 3.5 million slaves. Most of them were their point of entry was the harbor, the port in Salvador, which is the capital of Bahia. So it has incredible African heritage. Aside from that, then you have all this European influence, and it's not just like, oh, Italians, it's just like everyone from Europe. The beginning, too, wasn't even, immigration didn't happen exactly like it did here. There weren't necessarily pilgrims in the beginning. The Portuguese came over, and their interest was just getting as much wood and resources as they could, and then just like going back to the king and kind of like being bathed in glory. And the people that ended up staying at first were what they were called the degraded ones, the degredados, who were basically gypsies and Jews and convicts and anyone else who was undesirable in Europe, who they're like, "All right, you know what, there's this place in the other, way far away, this ship might sink, and you know, there might be some cannibals there. So, you know, go, you know, do the king a favor and you know, check things out over there and tell us what happens." You know, so they dumped all these people over there too, and the Portuguese came, and the slaves came over, and it eventually was a big sugar culture that arose and became very profitable, and Bahia kind of rose in the world, and Salvador became a major world city. But the process was very violent and very difficult, and it, in the process, this kind of chaos, cultural mixing that went on, people blended together, and it produced what I guess is the Bahian, which is this incredible mixture of culture and blood, right? So you have indigenous blood, African blood, and then European blood of all different varieties. And so it has this kind of like magical quality when you talk about Bahia. You know, it's so different, so unique from every other place in Brazil. I lived with people from the south, actually, when I was living close to Captain Grosso for a time. Professors, they taught at a university there, and whenever they would talk to their parents on the phone, they would be like, you know, they'd be like, oh yeah, mom, all right, I'll be back in Brazil in like 2 weeks, you know, as if, you know, when they were going to go home, they'd be going back to Brazil, and if Bahia was some other place, you know, And I would meet people in who would come to Salvador, come to Bahia too, and they would be, you could just tell the look on their face that they were just totally impressed by this place. It was nothing like where they came from in the south of Brazil, which is a more European place. It's got these traditional, it's more like America in a sense. It's got these, it's a heavy German and not less British, but also just a mix of French and German and people from the Mediterranean as well. So people, it's a loaded word. You know, people think of, when they think of Bahia, then you, all these stereotypes come to mind. You have this image of like a Pai de Santo, which is like a priest from Candomblé. Candomblé is that the syncretic religion that arose in Brazil from, I guess, polytheistic African religions and Catholicism. And so you have these, the Catholic saints, which have two names. You know, one, the Catholic name, and then you have the name of the Brazilian deity who's associated with the saint. And people, and then you have priests, and there's animal sacrifices involved, and there's a whole other spiritual world that's involved in Candomblé. So when people think of Bahia, they automatically think of this priest who's like, you know, who's doing some kind of voodoo, or like, you know, sacrificing a chicken or something like that. Or they're thinking of maybe like the beach and the typical mulata image, which is like the kind of sensual Brazilian woman who's like, you know, the fruit on her head or whatever, you know, like a. You know, seducing people, or you know, mulher de acarajé, like the woman who sells acarajé, which is also kind of like usually an African woman in a big white dress who sells these traditional foods that are kind of like it's hard to describe, but it's African tradition mixed with what's uniquely kind of Brazilian. So it's shrimp and this sauce called batapat, spicy, it's very tropical, it's a delicious thing. And they're just kind of like the image of Bahia. And that's just the coast, you know. So when people do think about the interior of Bahia, it's usually, which is where I lived, people usually think about, you know, there's like two images, and it's usually what they see on television. It's either like bandits or it's some kind of horrible drought. You know, those are the images, you know. So you have this, it's kind of like the Wild West, kind of like our tradition out west. Not so much so these days, but for a long time it was like that, and it's an image that still kind of persists. It doesn't have nearly as much infrastructure as the other parts of the country. It's kind of like backwaters. For a long time there was still dirt roads. The city where I lived in, for example, didn't have electricity until 1972, I think. And it wasn't even a city then. It was kind of like a gas station, like a bunch of farms. And they would tell me they used to go to the gas station to watch the football games. Like everyone would go down there, and they had like some kind of receiver, and it was like this staticky little television. But everyone would go up because that was like the place. And this is in the 70s, you know. And then later on, they opened up a movie theater there. But they like had to bring the power like a kilometer via this gas station down to this guy's house, like by the. In the middle of like this farm, you know, and then everyone would come to the farm and they'd watch movies, you know, and this is how it was for a long time. So there's not a lot of, you know, Bahians don't really get a break, you know. They're either like some kind of magical African priest, or you know, like some kind of seductive mulata, or they're just like hillbillies, basically, from the interior. There's the bandits. You have this tradition of banditry, and his name was Lampion, who's like their famous bandit who like ransacked the interior of a number of different states from the northeast of Brazil for like almost 20 years, you know, and it's kind of Wild West shootouts and this idea of drought too, which is like everyone's just always, it's always drought racked. Even when it's not, people are just, the cows are dying, people are suffering, you know, which is part of the culture, but it's not all that the culture is. So you have these images that are very pervasive, and there's no room for buy-ins just to kind of live in the images, you know, just what they can't be normal. They're not like, they're not to be normal things, you know, they're either dying of drought or, you know, or they're doing some kind of black magic voodoo. So it's important, you know, that's, I think that's what photography it really makes possible then, kind of like, especially when you work in a community setting like this involving kids, teenagers, young adults, it gives them the power then to kind of take back the way that they're represented or seen by a number of people and to say, look, you know, I can do this, you know, I can play a role in representing myself. And this is how, you know, we're normal people, just like, you know, these are things that make us unique, and they're not these exaggerated things, that they're not these horrible things that you see on the news. You know, we have a life that's dignified and interesting, just like anywhere else in Brazil. So I think that was a big focus of the photography course, you know, was just giving kids presenting them the magic of photography, which is amazing, you know. It was a digital course, so we didn't have all the joys of the darkroom and film and all that, but that was a big part, you know, giving them the courage and the possibility to be courageous and say, look, this is who we are. And it's important. It's just as important for their image to the outside world as it is within the community itself. You know, the book, when we published the book, and the idea of having photographs in the community was pretty radical, actually. It was really cool to work with art in this context because it was a small city and there really weren't any other, we're starting from scratch, there'd never been a photography exhibit before in the city. And there weren't really any art spaces either. So it was kind of like we got to kind of organically kind of build this up, you know, through the course and figure out ways to present photographs and make them interesting and relevant to the community. And it was kind of the idea of seeing these photographs and seeing photographs of the everyday world was kind of shocking. It's something that we're used to, but it was kind of shocking to a lot of people in the community because it's not like I was working in a vacuum at the same time. When I was researching how to teach the class and looking up stuff, I was reading the work of Wendy Ewald, she worked with a lot of different community photography settings around the world, and she taught a course in like the Himalayas with children who never had access to a camera and weren't accustomed to the idea of even seeing the world through a frame. The idea of having, you know, of thinking about the world, and it was something we see. I think we see the world more through a frame these days than we do through our own eyes. You know, but the idea that to the kids that they would have to kind of select something with a frame and what they saw wouldn't necessarily all appear, but it'd be within this one limited space, was new to them, you know, and it was this kind of radical concept. But in Bahia, that's not the case. I mean, even though it is kind of a more remote area, it was also already permeated with visual culture. There's a musician, Tom Zay, who I really like, and he's called it the dictatorship of the image. You know, what was once a very oral culture would become kind of overrun already with images that come in principally through the TV and through magazines, but which have a really strong impact on the way people see themselves. So when people take pictures there, or the way they would take pictures, it's always kind of like they were in this imaginary world of fashion. You know, they were all kind of like glamorous models, and it's something that we all do with photos. You know, but it was definitely within this one kind of like commercially inspired way of thinking about photography, and the idea that you would take a picture in a setting that wasn't necessarily kind of prearranged, you know, like for a party or for some kind of formal event, was actually a very new idea for a lot of the kids. And they took to it immediately. But a lot of the people in the community had never kind of thought about photography that way. So the idea of talking about community based on some very kind of everyday ideas, especially through pictures, was really foreign. They're like, oh, you can't show that. That's such a, why would you take a picture of that? You know, the book has, I'm going to show the pictures in a little bit, but the book is has a number of images that kind of like, I think, shock people in a lot of ways. And it was important for the community as well. It's a place in the interior of Brazil, but it's within a very rural setting. It's still kind of steeped in a rural culture, but it's also this weird urban environment that just kind of arose. Capingrosso, the small city where I live, is on a kind of crossroads and it connects the basically the north of Brazil to the south. So anything that would be coming out of the mouth of the Amazon, way in the north in the city of Belém, has to go through Capingrosso if it's going to any of the major cities in the south. So through this kind of trade, the city arose, and it's, all of a sudden it's got, you know, everyone, people are getting money kind of faster than they normally would, and they've got motorcycles, and there's all this global culture coming in. You go there and there's like, you know, there's goths, you know, and there's punks, and there's like people, kids playing Counter-Strike and cyber cafes, you know. So it is kind of like, it's a modern place too, and people kind of behave, and this isn't something that's unique to Bahia, they behave like they have nothing, they're now not recognizing their former selves. You know, it's like, you know, they're from a very rural setting, but they're not actually behaving like they are. They live like they're in Manhattan. So people are very concerned about, you know, we're in a drought, and people are outside like washing their cars, you know, or it's 110 degrees out, and people are cutting their trees down, you know, because they don't like the way the leaves kind of like mess up fall on the ground and like kind of pollute the environment. They have very specific, you know, this has to be clean like this, you know, very detailed about that. And you know, schools are falling over, and they're building this really ornate, elaborate plaza with like Roman columns or something like that, you know. So they have this very, very specific sense of how things should be. It's kind of detached from what the reality is. And this isn't all people, but a lot of people that administrate, the mayors and the people that are in power, feel that they should behave. You know, this is what a proper city should have. It should have a plaza with like Roman columns, which I don't know where that came from, you know, but that's what they kind of feel is important to invest in when the schools are falling over and there's a health crisis, the hospital can't attend people. So it's important, I think, for photographs kind of find a way to kind of reflect about that and to take things that are we don't want to look at and make them interesting and even beautiful. So that was kind of like a fundamental piece of the course, is talking about how things that happen every day and we don't assume that are photographable are actually very beautiful, you know, and there's beautiful in the simple, you know, reality is beautiful, you know, and the kids from the course really got this, and they ran with it. So the course, again, it was a digital course. We didn't have the joys of working in the darkroom, which is really cool, and something that I loved when I was learning photography here at MHS, but tried to kind of instill it with still the kind of artisanal aspects of photography. So the idea that even though it's digital, it doesn't necessarily have to be automatic or thoughtless, you know? And it doesn't have to be something you do without thinking through what you're taking a picture of. It's the central ideas of the course is like, just because we can doesn't mean that we should. You know, because we can take a million pictures, does that mean we actually should take a million pictures? What are we taking pictures of anyways? You know, what kind of message are we trying to convey with the pictures, right? And then the idea of actually working manually with digital cameras and still measuring light, which is something that's not, you know, it's, you don't have to know about anymore. You can just, all you have to do is press a button and, you know, the world is there, you know, at your fingertips. But the idea of kind of like measuring light and working with the mechanics of a camera and remembering that there is a mechanical process and what happens with it and what you can do when you understand how that works is really important as well. So, you know, those are two fundamental parts of the course. It really is kind of stripping things down to its basic. Instead of kind of creating a concept of what photography is, it's kind of taking things away in a sense and just stripping it down to what is absolutely essential. And a lot of that I would tell the kids, just like, you know, it's not a great secret. I don't even know exactly how things ended up working out so well, but I would just tell them, look, no zoom, you can't use zoom, no flash, right? If you want to take a picture of something, you have to, you know, you have to go up to it. You can't just like stand far away and zoom in and just like be content with that. And you can't just like, oh, here we have a flash, let's just illuminate and take a picture and that's done, right? So those are important elements of the course. And I think the most important thing was just the idea of kind of like the joy of discovery that photography brings. It's just, it's a simple thing in a sense. You don't have to have a lot of elements. It's like the kids would always amaze me in the community because they would make these kites out of like plastic bag and like some sticks and some twine, and all of a sudden the kite, you know, and they'd spend hours doing it, and the kites would be flying in the air, and just like, how did they do that? You know, it's, they have so few resources to do that with, and yet they can make these really cool toys and kind of entertain themselves. And that's what I feel like photography is in a way too, is you don't have to have a lot of resources to do something really interesting with it and to kind of like let the breezes of art kind of like lift you up into the air and take you places. Because there's no doubt about it, once you start studying photography, then you start to get interested in other things. You look at other people's pictures, and all of a sudden you're thinking about what's going on in the United States or what's going on the other side of the world, and you start to see connections, and you start to see, oh, these people are kind of like us, these people are different. And that's, I never thought about that way. You know? So it's this kind of portal into other worlds, right? And it makes you understand your own world in a totally different light. And these are kind of essential things that I think are lacking, not only in Bahia, in an interior situation where there really aren't any resources or effort at all devoted to art, but in general, you know, it's part of art education that's just underexploited. It's just not used at all. So that was kind of like a fundamental part of the course as well. And the interconnectedness in the end, which is kind of like using photography as a means to connect to other things. So it wasn't just me that was teaching the course. I had other colleagues and photographers whose work I brought, and you guys can check it out afterwards, who worked with a number of different ideas as a photographer who's from Bahia, but who has a project called Existences Resistances, who's worked with a lot of different ethnic groups who have been suffered some type of oppression or in a fight to maintain their identity. So he's gone, worked with the Zapatistas in Mexico, and he's gone to Palestine. And taking pictures of the Palestinian conflict, and he's worked in Bahia with the landless farmers movement. And so the idea, you know, he brought all these images in to show the students, and all of a sudden they were kind of like, you know, they were thinking about these ideas and these places that they never thought of it before. And they might not have been interested in thinking about it had they not seen the photographs and had the reality not been presented to them in a very visceral way. And then another friend of mine who worked with circuses, she lived with, Bahia has this gypsy, it's kind of like gypsy heritage, you know, like kind of Moorish heritage too. And there's all these itinerant circuses that are kind of still roam the interior of Bahia that are kind of family-owned, homemade types of things. And she lived for a month with these circuses, so she brought the images of these in. And it kind of, I think it really, it was really shocking and beautiful to see these images, you know. So it was a way to kind of have a contact with their own culture, and then also see these other cultures and start thinking about their own culture in relation to the other ones. See some pictures, I guess, huh? So, this should fire up pretty fast. So the book that we published then, here, let me just get it. The book that we published is kind of like a culmination. It's kind of like a greatest hits of all these photographs that we did over the course. The course is three years long, and here's the cover of the book, Captain Grosso. Captain Grosso actually means thick grass, and the grass is kind of like the prairie grass that we have around here, which is a weird coincidence in my life, to end up in a place so far away with prairie grass. And it's, again, the book is kind of like a compilation of all these images that were inspired by the course, but were always directed towards the idea of looking at your own city and your own place and trying to kind of investigate it and see what it is and see what makes it unique and different from any other place. Right? And to get outside of these typical images that we see of Bahia. So I guess I'll show some pictures really quickly from the book and maybe a few other pictures about what we did in the during the course, and then I guess you guys can ask me some questions too. No, I'm all right. So this is an online, this site's really cool, it's called ISU. It's a way to, in English it's probably something else, I've always called it ISU. And it's a way to post publications on in very nice viewable format online. So this is this isn't the whole book, it's just a section. So there's two essays that were written. I wrote one, kind of a preface, and this is another one by a colleague of mine, Rogério, talking about the work. And here's some of the pictures from the book. This is actually the image that we used a fragment of on the cover. And this is the grass that gives the city its name. I always like this photograph this is one of my, it's kind of an emblematic photograph. Because aside from being something that a lot of people from the community recognize, because they all grew up, it's a small, it's 25,000 people, but, you know, if you stand in the middle of the main avenue, you can see both sides of the city, you know, and you had this grass kind of surrounded it initially. Now it's kind of little by little being destroyed or paved over. But everyone who lived there, you know, from the beginning of the city till even the kids from my course, all had memories of growing up and kind of playing in the grass, or like being out there and just having these like childhood experiences in this wild area. So this is a picture that kind of, I think, really brought a lot of people into the book. And it was also one of these pictures that arose out of another concept in the course, which is just like going back and not just giving up after you go out and take pictures once. You know, maybe you can go back and find something else, which is something I always kind of stress with the students, in which they never, some of them resisted in a lot of ways. Like, I already went there, I already took pictures, why do I need to go back? You know, I've done this already. It's like, well, go back, see what else you can find. Maybe you can get another picture, you know. So this one student, Eliani, she was like, no, I'm not going back, I'm not going to go back. And I was like, just go back, just see what you get. You know, it's worth another shot. Sometimes you have to go back, sometimes you have to try again, you know. Maybe you'll find something you didn't see before. So she went back, and she took this picture, which ended up being one of the principal pictures and the one we put on the cover of the book. So let's see here. I love that Felipe, the kid with the cat. He's my neighbor, man. he's a great kid. And these pictures, you know, there are 17 students that made this book, that contributed photographs to the book. So they have their individual worlds that are kind of assembled collectively and combined to create this group portrait of a place, which is what I think makes this book unique. That's a Licorice palm. That's kind of like a desert palm tree that's unique just to the area around Captain Grosso. And it produces these tiny little, they're called the tiny coconuts, which are those little things over there. That you can see in one of the women, she's the women are the traditional people who break the nuts. You can see in her hands, beneath her hands. Yeah, they're all my. They're not children. My students were, when they started the course, they were 15, 16, 17. Now they're about 20 years old, so they're teenagers. There was one, Georgie, actually. He was one of the older students. He was 42 from the country. I'll show you a picture of him. So he was young at heart. This picture over here was a big, you know, this kid is kind of like famous in the city too. It's kind of hard to see, huh? It's a little bit dark. But he was, you know, he's kind of like this little rapscallion. You know, he's like a little rascal. You know, he's like out in the city all the time, and he's always asking for, like, kind of bugging people, asking for money or something. And so one of my students took this amazing picture of him and his friends outside of the city on one of their bird hunts, I guess. And you know, he's got a slingshot, and they call him Little Eyes because he has this little squint. So we used this picture to kind of promote the book when we were releasing it, and we made posters that we put all over the town, and you know, everyone was just like, oh my God, I can't believe it's him, you know, when he saw himself, and he was like, what am I doing on this picture? You know, he was all he was all, you know, blown away by the experience. So there are a number of, there really are intimate pictures. This is a picture from inside a Casa di Farina. Another one, which is where they make farinha, which is this traditional flour that they put on food. It's part of the staple of the Northeastern diet.
Did people in the community buy this book?
Yeah, people bought it. It's being sold still, actually. We made 1,000 prints. The first edition was 1,000 print run. And it's, I don't know, when we released it, we probably sold about 60 the first night. And then I think it's still selling to this day. I actually brought a bunch back here to kind of to get out as well. But it's not. It's interesting to make a photography. Books aren't really part of the culture in the Northeast. It's a very oral culture, and the idea of buying a book is kind of foreign to people. And being a photography book is even more strange. So it was kind of a new concept. But a lot of the people really, really loved it. There were other people that again were really kind of disturbed by some of the image, like this one over here. You know, people were just like, well, you can't show, how can you show a picture of a woman picking lice out of her, or, you know, looking for a fleas in her son's hair. It was like, you can't do that. You know, people were gonna. Someone said that we would lose. Captain Grosso would lose tourism because of that picture. It hurt their economy. You know, and it's like people were really kind of nervous about being presented in the way. And this is it's a typical scene. You see this all over the place. People kind of just laid out outside on the sidewalk, totally relaxed, and you know, helping each other out, you know, grooming each other. It's just a very normal scene. So there's 60 photographs in the book. There's just a small portion on here. Let's see. This is the poster we used to release the book in Captain Grosso. And here's a few images of the different ways that we ended up doing exhibitions and showing pictures around town. You know, this is in a school, one of the high schools, where we you know, there are no art spaces, so you have to kind of just improvise things and find places that where people will see them. This is in the plaza. He was one of the first residents of Captain Grosso. His farm used to be where that plaza is. Some of my students. That was a studio workshop we did with Ricardo, who was a professor, a friend of mine. That's when we had a mobile exhibit. My students, Lulu, Francieli. You have to find a way to make art get to the people. That's a big part of the city, a big part of the project. So people don't necessarily set aside time to go to a museum or to go see art. It's just not something that happens. There aren't any museums, you know. So this is a view from inside my place of work. This is us editing the photographs for the book, everyone getting together and thinking about what photographs to select out of the thousands that we had. Some of my students. That was a box we put photographs inside, and you can kind of move through them like a reel by moving these little sticks. And the kid, when we put it inside that little tent, and we said, look inside, and people formed this line. It was like a mile long to look inside the box. There were kids that were trying to sneak in like under the covering of the walls to get another look at the box. That's hard to see. That was when we released the book. Yeah.
Stick around for afterwards informally. But Charles, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Sorry to have to cut you off.
I guess I have copies of the book up here if you guys want to actually like take a look at it and see what's in it. I really think you should. I maybe should have brought more, but there's some up here. I brought other books that some of my colleagues have published about gypsies in Bahia and about the circus that I was talking about. And I guess if you have any questions, you can just come up and ask me. But that's it. You know. Thank you.